The Right to Question is supported in part by the Paul Allen Family Foundation, by Humanities Montana, and by listeners like you.
What is a yurt?
A yurt, the way we built it, is a traditional Mongolian ger. That's a style we built it off of. It's a nomadic structure that people in Central Asia have used for centuries. You can put it up and take it down in an hour and put it on your cart and move it wherever you need to go. It has a skylight at the top. The walls are a lattice wood. And then there are 60 roof poles that shoot up to the skylight to hold it up. And the whole thing is wrapped in canvas. And there's a wood stove in it. So it's essentially a tent.
Welcome to The Right Question, a program that features authors who write from and about the Western United States. I'm Cherie Newman talking with Molly Carroll May about her memoir, The Map of Enough. The first years of your life included a lot of moving around, which you write about in the first pages of the book. So let's just hear a short passage.
Some say that your first 10 years of life organize your entire perception of who you are. That's a serious statement. I sat under a cottonwood tree, wind rustling in the grass by my legs, and thought it out. But not for long, because how could I not agree right away? That young girl occupied a literal present tense in my adult life. No matter where I went, she would surface in my memory with flashbacks that came to me during the most common moments. Buying cucumbers at the grocery store, petting my dog on the porch, filling my car with gas in the middle of nowhere. She spoke as if she were still alive and always close. Maybe that girl was bolder than me. Maybe I wanted to retain her. Her stories populated my body, and she always appeared when I needed her most. Somehow her presence overshadowed, for an instant, the many small disappointments of self that had amassed over time. Under the cottonwood tree, I unlaced my shoes and fell into the past. When my father walks down the rolling lawn toward me, I unlace my roller skates and step onto the driveway. We are visiting from abroad, the word my parents use, which must mean that where we live is foreign to us, even though this place, my grandparents' house on the Chesapeake Bay, feels more foreign to me. The air here smells of salt, of heat, of mowed grass. Everyone else is lounging up the hill by the house, probably eating Triscuits and cheese. That's what we do when we come here, and we also play with the Russian dolls and page through all the old maps. My father puts a hand on my shoulder, crouches down to eye level, and asks if he can talk to me. Before I say yes, I test my almost double-digit self, and I wait a few long seconds just to feel what would happen if I said no. It's about a new job, he explains. Oh, that's familiar. It's the next line that throws me. In a few months, we will be moving to America. Because I don't know how to absorb this information, I scream at him. I hate America! I run away hard, my feet still in white socks, slapping across the black asphalt. At the old dock, I collapse onto rough planks. Even though I like moving, moving to America is going to ruin everything. I don't know exactly why. I just know it's true. Hot tears run down my already flushed cheeks. But the humid air eventually pulls me upright, and my legs dangle out over the green water, and I am watchful. The peninsula spreads out to nowhere, but I don't know that word peninsula yet, or that the long bird coasting by is a blue heron, or that the capital of America, which people really call the United States of America, is 45 minutes away. Or that there is a state with the same name as the capital, only it's on the other coast, the rainy one. My grandparents, the ones who live here now, aren't even from here. They grew up as Americans in Chile and raised my father while moving from Hawaii to Japan, to Germany, to Montreal, to Belgium, to England. And so far, my father has chosen for us the same wandering life. From Australia to the Dominican Republic, to Spain, to Mexico, and now to America. The crab cage stares at me. It hangs over the water. Piled on top of one another, the crabs are oblivious to chaos and also to their future. This afternoon, when my cousins and second cousins come over, while ears of corn boil in pots, we will paint black numbers on the crabs' shells, line them up like prisoners, and make them race down the scalding driveway. My two younger brothers can't wait for the awesome event. I end up chewing my fingernails. Reaching into the cage, I dodge the clacking of claws and feel brave. One by one, I pull crabs out and fling them into the still water. Plunk, plunk, plunk. I agree with the sound of freeing crabs. They splash, they descend into the murk, into the seaweed and sand, float on their backs, legs splayed out, bellies white as ghosts. As the crabs go back to their element, my pigtails feel too tight, and suddenly, I'm not sure where I am from, and it feels like the most urgent question of my life. Soon, I'll be sitting in a classroom where a teacher will hand me the crisp white sheets of an entrance test. I will learn how to fill in ovals with a number 2 pencil, and also that I need to repeat a grade because I have no answer for the question of how many coins get dropped into a toll booth. I don't know what a toll booth is. I don't know about American quarters or nickels, even though, by lineage, I am American.
Once you were living in the U.S. and trying to fit in with kids your own age who didn't have any understanding of a transient lifestyle, you developed an identity as a global girl from nowhere, someone who was, quote, obsessed with where I had been and where I would go. What did that identity do for you socially?
I think it allowed me to really stand behind something that made me feel cool, to use a really simple word, made me feel okay and adequate in the way that we all want to feel. And people responded pretty quickly to it whenever I would explain where I had grown up. And that sort of sent shivers up my spine, and I felt like, oh, I'm accepted. So it was my truth, and it's not something I fabricated, but I used it a lot in moments when I felt insecure or unsure.
It made you cool because you weren't like everybody else.
Essentially, yeah, because I was different in some way to them. And I hadn't ever really known that, obviously, when I was living it, because you don't when you're in the middle of it.
We learn by comparison, I think.
Exactly.
So why did you and your fiancé, Chris, who is your fiancé then and your husband now, why did you decide to move to Montana?
We were living in New York City at the time, and not with any sense of permanence for that place, but we knew that we were ready to leave, and we wanted to go to a natural environment, which we had been in before, but we'd never really lived in a mountain town together, and we needed a place to go that would be easy and where we could live rent-free, because we were sort of taking a risk financially. And my family owns some land in Montana near Bozeman, and that was an option. It was really our only true option, and it felt like a good one, and we thought we would probably be here for a year and a half. And that was it. We knew very little, actually, about the place.
So 4-plus years later.
Right.
You are still there.
We are.
Do you think that living on what you call, with a capital T and a capital L, the land, do you think that taught you how to connect with something solid in yourself after such a transient youth?
Mm-hmm. I do. In part, I think it's because it is a wild place. You know, it's not a place constructed by humans, that particular piece of land. But it's also just settling in for a period of time. And there's a real quieting that happens, or happened for me. And any time, at least in my experience, any time I'm surrounded by trees or animals, everything calms down. And my sense of urgency about whatever my sense of urgency might be about really is sort of put into perspective. So I do feel, when I talk about the land now with people, I say it's really my grounding place. I feel grounded there. And I didn't know what it was like to feel grounded until I did. You know, I thought I'd had moments of it before. And I'm sure when I'm older, I'll really have a better sense of that. but for now, it's the closest I've come to it.
And even though there was a lot of stress because you didn't have jobs, you had to figure out a way to make some money.
Yep.
You still managed to find some grounding.
Yeah, I did. I think the grounding came more once we were living in the yurt. The whole building of the yurt and trying to sort of figure out our community and figure out how we were going to keep money incoming was pretty stressful for me in particular, and Chris. But once we were settled into the living and we'd made some friends and I was teaching and he was working, we sort of sent down a little taproot.
We'll get back to the yurt in a minute, but you and your friends have been faced with the conundrum, probably exacerbated by access to the internet, mm-hmm. with having too many choices. And you write about that in an exchange with your friend Katinka, who chose a life that's pretty much the opposite from mm-hmm. you. Mm-hmm. Would you mind reading that passage?
Sure. Some people escape sound for quiet. Some people do the opposite. I dialed Katinka's number. She had just bought an apartment in New York. Malls, she answered. It works, I said. I'm calling from the medicine wheel. I didn't know whether I'd get reception. How are you? How's the new pad? We're getting settled, she explained, and told me about buying furniture for all the nooks, about the shared rooftop patio and its view of the East River, about how good it felt to create a home that wouldn't have to be reconsidered every lease cycle. It, of course, came with some loss because to make any choice involves the loss of some other choice you could have made. She could have been here. I could have been there. She was sad not to live in the country or have her own herb garden, but that's why she could ask people like me to harvest some wild bee balm for her. Her life had knit itself around the city, and in that she found comfort and community. We talked it out, laughing at how stubborn we and most of our friends had been about limiting our options at all. So how are you feeling about Montana, she asked. I didn't answer right away. I picked a stem of yarrow, rubbed its soft leaves, and brought the scent to my nose. Well, I started, remember that time in Santa Fe when you took me to that rundown park to show me some meditation techniques and breathing? Yeah. That was almost 10 years ago, I said. Do you remember what happened? You asked me to close my eyes and take in a deep, long breath. It was probably the first time I had ever done that, because gloppy tears started running down my cheeks. I couldn't stop crying with that one breath. I do remember. That place, I explained. That place inside me, that's the place I want to know well. Instead of deciding that this place or some other place or a set of places is going to soothe me. But she said, you're already good at being internal. Not in the serene way, I laughed. I just see all of us, okay, not all, but most of us, and I'm the worst, grabbing for that perfect what, where, who, and elsewhere, away from ourselves. And then once we have them, we crave a better version of them, like lunatics. Those are all external. Those things don't last, you know? I know. I know I'm sounding all blah, blah, blah. Eating this raw cheese right now is enough, she mumbled with a full mouth. Well, there you go, I laughed. Don't you think that it's human nature to want something better, she asked. Sure, I said, but it's exacerbated by modern life. For our grandparents or even our parents, there wasn't this rampant internet info out there about the 5,842 lives you can live, and oh man, which one will you choose, and then what will that say about you? That's true. All I'm saying, I continued, staring into the dense firs ahead of me, is that the incessant search for those things hasn't produced a content person out of me, or other people I know. It's an epidemic, and I'm not sure I want to be part of it anymore. I can see that, she answered. But what's the real alternative? I don't know, I said.
You sort of do know by the end of the book a little bit.
A little bit, yeah.
You're listening to The Right Question. I'm Cherie Newman talking with Molly Caro May about her memoir titled The Map of Enough. If you tuned in late or you would like to share this program with a friend, you'll find audio online at mtpr.org/twq. It's also posted at our Facebook page. After a short break, we'll be back to talk about internal and external domes. Don't go away. There's a scene in the book where you were swimming in a pond and you recognized that you wanted to get out of the water because the wind was making you kind of cold, but you also didn't want to get out. And you realized, quote, that either or could be replaced by both and. Mm-hmm. How did that realization change your ideas about your place in the world?
It's so huge. It seems so simple, but it really is my answer, at least for now, and the choices I'm making. So I've realized through actually the coaching of a mentor that I can both be rooted in this place in Montana and I can leave every, you know, 5 or 6 years and create a new life somewhere for a year or two and then return. So for me, it's this twinning of having a place to speak from and a place to be of, but then going completely out of my comfort zone somewhere else to really grow in the way that I crave and need, and then to return back to that grounding place. So it's sort of simple and it sounds formulaic, but it's really has brought me a lot of ease.
Yeah, I don't think it's very simple because all the time that you are staying put, you are also thinking about leaving. And doesn't that divide your mind in some way?
Yeah, that's a good question. I don't know because I haven't fully engaged it yet. You know, I'm just 4.5 years into living here. So we'll see how that works. But I don't know. I don't have an answer for that. I think that there's part of me that is always, regardless of whether I do it or not, is always going to be thinking ahead to what could be the next great place to live or even vacation. I think we all do that. We're all looking for something to blow our own minds. And so if that for me can be a place that I live and engage with, that's more nourishing to me than some great vacation I go on for 2 weeks.
Mm-hmm. You do realize that there are people who grow up in a town and live there their whole lives and somehow find a reason to stay there and nourish themselves with the community.
Yep.
Either that or they're too afraid to leave where they are.
Yeah. I think probably both, but I'm really fascinated by those people because that's so opposite of my experience.
You and Chris built a yurt together the first summer and fall that you lived on the land. And I know from reading the book that it was a long and complicated process, which you accomplished in a very short amount of time. I mean, you built it from scratch. Mm-hmm. So just give us a summary of what you had to do in order to get that structure to live in.
We started with a bunch of wood planks, and we used machines that Chris is a woodworker, so he had a shop that we set up, and we used those machines to plane things down and shape them. The walls of the yurt, to create a waste for the walls, you have to steam bend the pieces of wood. So we soaked those in the pond, and we created a contraption to steam bend them, and then we had to sew the canvas, and then we had to hike it all up a hill, a pretty steep hill, and then put it up. So it was a lot of little pieces and a lot of repetitive work. You know, 60 roof poles, doing the same thing, hand planing 60 roof poles. So for me, it was more that I grew impatient. I thought it was going to take a month. It took 3.5 months. You know, I was ready to live in it and have an experience.
And then just about the time that you were ready to finish it, your parents came to visit.
Right.
which is another short passage I'd like you to read. I love this because it really demonstrates the difference between you and your husband, and yet you complement each other very well.
After 3 days brushed by a cold wind, the stain dried. We covered the floor with another blue tarp to protect it. Having a floor was like having one arm wrapped securely around our future here. Nothing was in our way now, other than potential weather. We'd finished almost all the wooden components, walls, roof poles, and a skylight. Now we just needed to make a door, sew the canvas, haul everything, plus the wood stove up the hill, and assemble. The yurt just had to be done before my trip back east for Christmas on December 15th. That gave us a few weeks. We're so, so close, I trilled at Chris. We're almost there. Getting there, he said. Then my parents arrived to spend 10 days with us over Thanksgiving. My worldly, open-minded father with big cheeks, the one who had slept on park benches and led tours in Russia, who either laughed so hard his face turned red or took up residence under the dark cloud of impatience, who refused to condone cultural stereotypes. And my graceful mother, who drove down unmarked roads just because, who would ask any question of any stranger, who chowed down on a bratwurst while recounting her modeling days in Japan, who was always mannered and had accepted that her daughter was opinionated and less willing to please than she had ever been. Without knowing it, they stepped right in front of that barreling force of us, and we screeched to a halt. After a few days of visiting with my parents, I was huffing like a horse. "We've got serious shit to get done," I whispered to Chris, the two of us squeezed into the single bed in the tiny office room. I was unfamiliar with a pace of hanging around, eating meals, and doing virtually nothing. "We'll get it done," he assured me. "But it's the end of November, and we can't do any of it while they're here. And, Molly," he interrupted, "they are your parents, and they own this place, and they are lovely people." "You're right," I said, cracking a window to hear trees rustle outside. "Thank you." He had always been my tall glass of water. Instead of stopping completely, we compromised and busied ourselves with side tasks, things that allowed us to play at importance, things that we had avoided, like getting firewood up to the top. Underneath the albino whale tarp beside the cabin, round logs peeked out at us, some frozen together or frozen to the ground. From leftover 2x4 planks and old jeans, we had built wooden packboards designed for turning our able bodies into efficient haulers. With a sturdy external frame part of the backpack, we could stack as many logs as possible up a person's back, lash them down, snap the waist belt, and go. It took a few false starts to learn. The logs smelled alive of pitch and rough brown bark, the last remnants of summer all collected under that tarp. They tumbled off, we repacked. Tumbled off, hit our shins, repacked. But eventually, we got it. 7 logs for me, 9 for Chris. My parents had bought us red rubber crampon-type things that strapped over our boots. It was an unexpected gift. Over glasses of wine, we had all laughed together about whether metal teeth were actually necessary for tracking up the ice path with heavy loads. But without them, nothing would have been possible. I called them grippers, because that's what they did for me. No slipping. We might have looked like every other human on this planet who carries her, because, let's be honest, the women do most of the domestic hauling. Water, sticks, tea leaves, food to sell at market, or gravel to move from one place to another. Even those who have never burdened their bodies might have cracked open a contemplative book to read that if you truly want to know yourself, you must start with one job. Chop wood, carry water. This adage would soon become literal for us. That first afternoon, strapping firewood to our packboards, I glanced back to the cabin where my father was cocked halfway out the door, pointing a camera at us, trying not to be seen, my mother's face right behind him, conspiratorial. My first thought, smile. Second thought, they are so curious and I love that. Third thought, my parents, like me, are tourists to everything. I placed another log, thunk, and paused to stare at the hill of fir trees leaning over me, so stately, so sure, as if they knew something none of us knew, as if their long, invisible roots reached out toward me. My head jerked back to my parents, and then back to the trees, and back to my parents. I had grunted a log from the frozen earth, loaded firewood onto a packboard with my fiancé, and failed to notice that a decent part of that felt normal. Maybe I was no longer a tourist to this life. And when I understood that, the trees, unsympathetic, shrugged as if to say, calm down, don't hyperanalyze.
When you and Chris were putting the yurt up, erecting the entire structure in the workshop before you actually hauled it up the hill and put it up, you recognized a link between the wooden slats of the yurt and the human rib cage. Mm-hmm. And you wrote, boundaries, of course, set a person free, but it would take the cells of my body a long while to begin to understand that concept. Where are you now with the idea of boundaries and freedom?
I think I'm in that place of still believing that we all crave some sense of boundary is such a negative word. I think we have negative associations with it. But what I really mean is sort of a structure in which we understand our own place. And I have grown up in this generation and in this culture where the goal is to have no boundaries, to be unlimited in your choices and possibilities. And I have witnessed in myself and in my friends that, and it's a privilege, right? It's a privileged position to be in, but that it actually creates great discomfort and it paralyzes a lot of people. And so I have found in my own choices, if I have a boundary or I have a structure, within that structure, I can go crazy and have a sense of freedom. Whereas if I don't have that, I just feel, I can feel overwhelmed and therefore not able to sort of explore within myself all the possibilities.
And that's kind of what it felt like you were doing throughout this book, was using the boundaries of the land and of building the yurt and of being constricted financially mm-hmm. to go inside yourself and look for ways that you could be free. And those boundaries created this book.
Absolutely. Yep. And they also created for me an invitation really to go within in a real way, not in just taking a meditation class here and there as I'd done before, but to really spend time alone and within. And that for me continues to be a real touchstone for me. And I don't think I think it would have taken me longer to find it. Not that I found a thing, but I found a small thing. And this place and this experience really allowed me to have that.
And one of the ways that you chose to go within was to kind of do a little visualization of a dome mm-hmm. inside of yourself. And I made the connection that a yurt in which mm-hmm. you were living was a dome, mm-hmm. a sort of a dome. And then you also were building this dome inside you. And I'd like to end with you reading a short passage that's on page 247.
My dome would be made of pale orange stucco flecked with mica. Past the open-air windows, desert plants grew, and past them, ether and white pulsing light available for everyone, all of us. There was no white picket fence here. This was a matured version of home. I could draw this light down from the top of my dome and into the minute crevices of my spine. No one could destroy my dome. No one could set fire to it or smash it or change it. It was the only for sure thing.
Molly Carol May lives near Bozeman, Montana. You'll find more about her and her writing, as well as links to our podcast and Facebook page at mtpr.org/twq. I'm Cherie Newman, wishing you a pile of fascinating books and lots of questions.
The Right Question is produced by Cherie Newman, with help from Barbara Thoreau and Kim Anderson. Michael Marsalek, executive producer. Beth Ann Ostein, studio engineer. Music for this program was written and performed by John Floridis. The Right Question has a Facebook page, a blog, and a podcast. You'll find links to all that at mtpr.org/twq. Thanks for listening and for supporting this program.